بسم الله والسلام على رسول الله وسائر الأنبياء وبعد فأعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها الناس إنا خلقناكم من ذكر وأنثى وجعلناكم شعوبا وقبائل لتعارفوا إن أكرمكم عند الله أتقاكم صدق الله العظيم. Dear brothers, sisters and friends, assalamu alaikum and good evening. I'd like to begin by thanking the Muslim society, the student society, for inviting me to address you this evening. And to be quite honest with you, I always look forward to such invitations, such occasions, where I can engage with what I regard as the future of Britain, young people, regardless of faith, color, or creed. We live in very difficult times, especially when you look at global situation from the Muslim point of view. Recent international events have managed to put the spotlight on Islam and on Muslims. Perhaps one could say that despite the great tragedies, some good always comes out of a tragic situation. And for me as a Muslim, it's pleasing to see that there is tremendous interest in my faith, in Islam, on the part of non-Muslims. The desire to learn more. Some are trying to learn about Islam to find out actually what it is that drives Muslims. I think it is only through acquiring an understanding of people who are different from us that we can begin to respect one another. Indeed, there are many people in the world today that wear the title of a Muslim, yet they don't actually practice Islam. And so it is very important for us as Muslims, those of us who are Muslim, to try our best to practice Islam in everything that we do. And just as important for our non-Muslim friends also, to be able to distinguish between Islam and the teachings of the faith and the practices of Muslims. Because of what has happened recently in the world, there is a school of thought that is developing that is suggesting that Islam is a threat to the West. I totally reject that, because I believe that Islam is not a threat to the West. Perhaps some Muslims could be a threat to some sections of societies that are living in the Western Hemisphere. And I think that can be true of all religions, or even of people without a faith, without a religion. There are always a small number of people present in every community, in every society, in every faith that will misunderstand the teachings of the faith and take them to an extreme end. And perhaps sometimes even go as far as to utilize the excuse of religion to justify their own goals and their own objectives. You'll have noticed that I used the word Western Hemisphere, and that was deliberate. Because I personally don't agree with any suggestion that there is something called Islam and the West, or Islam versus the West, or Muslims and the West. Because for me, as a Muslim who has taken residence in the Western hemisphere of the globe, I can't see how I can separate myself from these two descriptions of myself. I happen to be a Muslim who's living in the Western part of the world, Western hemisphere. Again, the Western hemisphere depends where you're standing on the globe, isn't it? If you're standing in Australia, I don't know which part of the globe is west and which part is east. So who decides what constitutes the west? Are we talking in geographic terms? Are we talking in economic development terms, in material terms? What are we really talking about? When Muslim civilization was at its peak, was it the west then? And now that it has taken a plunge, it no longer remains the West and now is the East? And is it because when Islam and Muslim civilization was at its peak, in comparison, civilization in this part of the globe was at its lowest? So did we refer to it as the West or the East? So these are, I think, really descriptions and terms which do not serve any purpose as far as I'm concerned. And I will attempt to provide to you evidence of the fact that Islam really can be a positive thing to have in any part of the world, and indeed it is a positive and a power for good wherever it is found around the globe. Now I'll try and talk about the relationship of the British Isles with Islam and Muslims, and see how far back we go when the earliest recordings of the British encounter with Islam were recorded. We observe now that we live in an extremely diverse society in terms of religion, culture, ethnicity, and so on and so forth. And over the decades, a new kind of Britain has come into being, one in which diversity is celebrated. Of course, you'll always find elements in every society and community who find this unacceptable. But by and large, we find Britishness has evolved, has changed tremendously over the last few decades. So if we go back, and you'll be surprised to know that the British encounter with Islam goes back to the 8th century. I couldn't believe it when I first read this. I was scratching my head and I was saying, all those thousands or hundreds of years ago, really did the British people come across Islam and Muslims that long ago? So we find in the 8th century that Muslim mappers and travelers who had mapped the continents of the world, we find that in their maps they were actually aware of the existence of the British Isles. And a number of places are actually mentioned in Al-Khawarizmi's map of the world, which was written in around 817. So a number of places in Britain are mentioned there. In 1796, a great king died. He was an Anglo-Saxon king, Offa of Mercia. King Offa, in his reign, had commissioned coinage to be minted. Now, of course, it would have his head as part of the the mark on the coin. But most interestingly, we find that on these coins, he had inscribed in Arabic the Muslim creed, the declaration of faith, that there is none worthy of worship but God, in Arabic. I don't think that Offa one night went to sleep and woke up in the morning having seen a dream and said, right, I'm going to mint coins with an Arabic inscription on it. And I don't think it was fashion in those days either. But this goes to prove that not only was there an encounter with Islam and Muslims, but it was an encounter of a deep nature, of a heavy kind. Because to have the creed of another religion, albeit it declares the oneness of God, but to have it in Arabic on your coinage could only come about if there was true friendship, if there was true respect for one another, if there was acknowledgement that indeed monotheists who believe in the oneness of God are really worshipping one God. And there should be no reason to fight one another. And so we find this the earliest kind of evidence of British encounter with Islam and with Muslims. And not very far from the British Isles, we find on the southern coast of Ireland, a cross was found. And the name of this cross is the Ballycotton Cross, a Christian cross. And it dates to around the 9th century. And this also bears an inscription in Arabic. And it's beautifully laid on the cross itself in glass bead, and it's in the Kufic Arabic script. And the inscription on this cross reads, Bismillah, in God's name. Let us look at how this encounter perhaps came into being, how it developed and how it progressed. It is generally believed that the first Englishman known for certain to have been a scholar of Arabic was Henry II's tutor, Adelard of Bath, who died in around 1125. He traveled in Syria and Muslim Spain, and he translated a number of Arabic texts into Latin. A very interesting development here, where rather than thinking along the lines of a clash of civilizations, the Britons of that day and age looked at it from a positive point of view, to say, the Muslims have something, and we want that. We want to acquire that. So they understood that just because a civilization is different to our own civilization, we don't have to be on course for a collision, but rather we could perhaps enrich our own civilization by tapping into that Muslim civilization. I think this is what it should be all about. To be able to better our own civilization by taking the good things and the nice things that we like in other civilizations. And that has happened throughout the history of mankind. And for us as Muslims, we believe that this is God's design, that He changes people's positions, people's situations throughout the ages. It's not static. There will be a time when a certain kind of civilization will peak, will reach a plateau and fall, only to be replaced by another, and so on and so forth. And history is full of this. the Greeks, the Romans, and so on and so forth. And perhaps at this juncture, if I might add, that it's possible that it is the same British attitude that prevails today also. Perhaps it's genetically inbuilt or something. When I reflect at the French situation, it's rather strange and bizarre that the French approach to integration, to maybe bringing different cultures and different civilizations together, at least as far as school children are concerned, is that you strip every school child of their peculiar and their special identities so that they are all equal. So Muslim girls should not wear the headscarves, Christian boys and girls should not wear the cross, and Jewish children should not express their Jewishness through symbols or through dress, etc., etc., etc. And they feel that by removing, by taking all that away, they will be able to create equality, that everybody is on a plane, on a level footing. Whereas the British attitude is very different. We find that we are allowed to express our identities in any way that we wish to. So here I am, turbaned, bearded, and nobody stops me from expressing my religious teachings in terms of my dress, and I'm allowed to do that. One might say, but yes, you are a grown up and you're an adult, so what about school children? Well, I can assure you that Muslim school children and other non-Christian school children also are allowed freely to express their religious teachings through dress and culture and so forth. And I think the British people have something to teach the French government. Perhaps not all French people agree with their government, but certainly the French could learn something from the British. And the British have not only tolerated diversity, to say, okay, you happen to be in this country, so we'll have to live with it, we'll tolerate you. No. But I think that most British have moved on from tolerance to respect. And I don't think it stops there. We've actually moved on from respect to celebrating each other's diversity. And certainly for me as a Muslim, I will celebrate everything good in other faiths and other cultures so long as it does not contradict my faith teachings. So it's not surprising when we hear that the national dish in Britain is chicken tikka masala. Because the British have appreciated that this is something to celebrate rather than rubbish it off to say it's too oily, it's too smelly, it's too hot, it's too this, too that. No, they have managed to see that it is a nice dish to have once in a while, and they love it so much that it's now our national dish. But let me tell you something else. In our home, if you ask me what's the favorite dish in our home, exactly, it's fish and chips. Perhaps we have learned to appreciate this. I mean, it is really an interesting way of eating a potato, isn't it? So there we have it. It is about celebrating difference, celebrating diversity, to be clever enough to tap into the nice things that humankind have to offer one another. I think if we can learn to do that, this world will be a beautiful place to live in. So we look at how the British people, the early Britons, realized that there was an immense wealth of knowledge, of culture, of civilization in Muslim land, and the best way that they could access it would be to learn the language, to learn Arabic. And they began to translate Arabic material into Latin. And many of us who study at universities and so forth in the different sciences owe a lot to these Arabic, to the Arabic treasure of literature that was translated into Latin and eventually into English. Some of the texts, Arabic texts, which were translated into Latin, we find Robert of Chester in 1145 translated Al-Khwarizmi's piece on algebra and mathematical calculations from Arabic into Latin. In the 14th century, we find that Muslim scholarship was now becoming more and more well known by the academics in Britain. Following from people like Adelard, who pioneered the learning of Arabic amongst the British, there were others who sailed from Britain in the 12th and 13th centuries in the quest of Arabic learning, and each of these came back and they enlightened their fellow country people. This included Daniel of Morley and Michael Scotus, whose translations of Aristotle from Arabic were of great value during the Renaissance. In the 16th and 17th century, this was a time when Muslim naval power dominated the Mediterranean. The whole expanse included Istanbul, the center of the Ottoman Sultanate, Aleppo, the crucial link in the Silk trade route, Beirut, where all the ships from Europe used to dock, Jerusalem, the city of pilgrimage, Cairo, a center of trade, Fez, a world for a city in the western part of Africa. That whole expanse was dominated by the Muslim naval force. And when the threat of the Spanish Armada loomed in the mid-1580s, Queen Elizabeth did not hesitate to ask the Ottoman Sultan, Murad, for naval assistance against the Spaniards. And of all the countries in Europe, Britain enjoyed the most extensive trade with Muslim lands. Now, inevitably, when there is such a degree and such a level of interaction, engagement, and encounter, there will be what we might term as conversion, one taking on the faith of another. And in this case, it was the Britons who opened up their hearts to Islam as a faith, as a religion, and began to adopt it. And we find that the first English revert to Islam, whose name survives in English sources, in a book entitled The Voyage Made to Tripoli, written in 1583, it says here, the son of a yeoman of our Queen's Guard, and his name was John Nelson. So it's as early as 1583, perhaps earlier. And as part of encouraging the British people to venture out into Muslim lands and tap into the civilization, a chair of Arabic was established at the University of Oxford in 1636. And it is well known that Charles I collected Arabic and Persian manuscripts. The Bodleian Library in Oxford has the manuscript of a letter written to Charles from Sultan al-Walid of Morocco. And part of this reads, "To our exalted presence has come your noble servant, John Harrison, well and in good health, and with far-reaching sincere hopes. He has taken up residence with us, encompassed by kindness and treated with all manner of generosity." And that is the Muslim spirit, to be kind, to treat everyone in a manner of generosity, no matter how different they are to you. But then there were some troubled times in the history of Britain, especially of England, with the turmoil of the Civil War, when things perhaps were rocked a little, and we find mention of tolerating the Mohammedans meaning Muslims, who are living in the London area. But that did not stop the thirst on the part of the Britons to learn more about this faith, this civilization. So it was not long, it was in 1649 when the first translation in English of the Quran appeared. This was done by Ross. It was very quickly sold out and they had to do a second print. That's an indicator of its wide circulation. After this, we find that even the ruling class in Britain began to make comparisons between their people and the people who were in power in Muslim lands and the subjects that they ruled over. After whatever happened in the Civil War, when Cromwell was in power as Lord Protector, reference to Islam and Muslims became part of the discourse. The royalists would attack the revolutionaries for the disrespect of parish priests and the rejection of the high Anglican official tenets. Ross, who translated the Quran, had lost his royal patron. He observes, and he writes, "And indeed, if Christians will but diligently read and observe the laws and histories of the Mohammedans," meaning the Muslims, "they may blush to see how zealous they are in the works of devotion, piety, and charity, how devout, cleanly and reverend in their mosques, how obedient to their priests, that even the great Turk himself will attempt nothing without consulting his mufti, the highest religious authority in Islam. The revolutionaries, according to their critics, followed their own self-declared religious authorities, while even the Sultan heeded the advice of the Mufti on religious matters." Cromwell, or his secretary, John Milton, even began to show that they were really, really familiar with the Quran. And one could find through their writings and through their speech that they were actually quoting the teachings of the Quran, albeit in their own, they were paraphrasing or they were expressing the teachings of the Quran through their own words. That a letter was written to the ruler of Algiers in 1656. This was to do with trade and commerce. And the attempt was being made to say, "Look, we will have business with you, we will trade with you." And of course, there are certain expectations. And now this is the British telling the Muslims of what they anticipate, what they expect in a relationship of trade and commerce. So it says to the addressee, "That we expect you to abide by the commercial agreements between the two countries because of the nature of the Muslim religion. We now, at this time, require the like of you who have declared yourselves hitherto in all things to be men loving righteousness, hating wrong, and observing faithfulness in covenants." This is the exact teaching of the Quran. So here you have Cromwell or his secretary preaching this message of the Quran to Muslims across the Mediterranean, that we are doing this business with you, knowing, fully aware, that you and your religion teaches righteousness, piety, and of course, faithfulness in covenant. You will fulfill your promise. You will not break the contract. If we move on and look at the academics of the not so very long ago, if you look at Isaac Newton, he was much influenced by Muslim scholarship. And there was a time when he was given a professorship, but the system in those days was that he would have to abide and take holy orders. Now secretly, Isaac Newton rejected Trinitarianism. He did not accept the idea or the theology of the Trinity, which meant that he would get into trouble with the king and he would be put to death. But luckily, Charles II granted him special dispensation and said, you are an academic, perhaps this doesn't apply to you, you don't need to take holy orders, you carry on what you're best at doing. And subsequently, all people, all other academics who held this chair were not required, they were exempted from the holy orders. But had he been put to death, we can all try to reflect back and see what gaps there might have been in modern science. We find texts in Arabic, in mathematics, astronomy, chemistry, medicine, all these that are central to higher education today and even in those days was the Muslim contribution to the development of mankind. And in order to obtain access to the advanced knowledge of the day found in Muslim lands, not only were translations commenced at Oxford and Cambridge, but preparations were made to train a generation of Arabic scholars. And it hasn't stopped since then. Even today, there are large numbers of British academics who are not Muslim, but have studied Arabic and can understand it, perhaps speak it even better than some Arabs, certainly better than I. So this is something that we reflect back on as the Muslim contribution to British society, or putting it the other way, the British ability to tap into a civilization that was different to theirs, but was richer than theirs, so they enriched themselves by tapping into that society. But if we come back to the colonial period, which was a very difficult time, not just for Muslims, but other religions and other people that were colonized by countries from the Western Hemisphere, in particular by Britain. We find if we looked at a map of Britain in 1897, you could see the empire stretching from the west coast of Africa, coming this way, Nigeria, all across Cairo, Egypt, coming across through the Middle East and going all the way into the Far East. A lot of these countries had large Muslim populations residing there. And it is an undisputed fact that it is the Muslim lands that provided the manpower and the material resources that contributed to the prosperity of Victorian and Edwardian England. And it is perhaps at this point where the tide turned. It is the colonial encounter which perhaps first brought Muslims onto Britain itself in large and substantial numbers. And they were brought over as sailors and as soldiers, or perhaps they came over indeed as students. And they established their first communities in the ports in England and in Scotland. And by the turn of the century, there were also several hundred Muslim traders, peddlers, who moved from town to town, city to city, selling their goods as far north as Scotland. And for a long time, during the reign of Queen Victoria, she employed two male Indian secretaries. Both were Muslim, Muhammad Baksh and Abdul Karim. They both entered the Queen's service 3 days after her Golden Jubilee in 1887. And although Baksh remained as an ordinary servant, the rank of a bearer, Abdul Karim made tremendous progress, eventually becoming Queen Victoria's secretary and an influential figure in the royal household. So the royals also benefited from Muslims. And indeed, it was not long ago when Prince Charles was visiting Markfield here in Leicestershire, where he shared his appreciation with Muslims who were gathered there to say, "My great-great-grandmother benefited from Muslims." And he talked about Abdul Karim. And he said, "My Queen Victoria learned Hindustani from Abdul Karim." And I would add to that, perhaps a lot of recipes were probably exchanged as well during that encounter. So this is perhaps a timeline dating Muslim encounter with the British people, or the British encounter with Islam. And we can reflect back and see that there is no reason why this cannot continue to be the case. For us as Muslims now, living in Britain, having made this home, many of you are probably born here, and feel that you don't know any other home and this is your home. And so we need to now look at it from the point of view of what it can be my contribution to Britain as a Muslim living in Britain, engaging in mainstream society. What good can I bring to humanity? How can I help in nation building, to build a Britain which is not just tolerant but respectful of everyone, which gives everyone room and the space to practice their faith without hindrance, without fear, to create a society that is just, that is peaceful? That, I think, is a challenge for us, and perhaps that needs another occasion to be discussed as a topic in its own right. Well, those are a few things that I wanted to share with you. I hope that you have found that useful, and I will now invite your comments. It's very interesting for me every time to listen to what young people think. You might have some comments that you want to make, or some questions that you might want to ask. Of course, I don't have all the answers, but perhaps your question will enable me to go back and read up some more. Thank you for this question. It's from a Hindu friend, and the Hindu friend is asking whether they are classified as a Kafir or non-Muslim. Well, we're going into what you might call semantics. It's a question of what term you use to define someone. There is an understanding in Muslim teachings about the belief in God. And so one who believes in God would be regarded as a believer, for example. The opposite of this would be one who rejects in the existence of God, who does not believe in God. And the Arabic words which describe rejection, the verb kafara, to reject, would be used for someone who rejects God. So you could say kafir is one who rejects God, and that is the Arabic term. I prefer to use non-Muslim because it then helps to cover everyone, whether they believe in God through a different faith tradition or they do not believe in God absolutely. Otherwise, one would have to continually name a number of faith traditions while they're talking. So when I say non-Muslim, it means everybody who's not Muslim. However, this is not to be taken as a derogatory term. It is simply for classification or for differentiation between a believer and a non-believer. It could easily have been any other word, which, if there was another word for it in Arabic, that would have been used. We also have within Islam the understanding of the people of the book. We do not believe that the Quran is the only word of God, but there are many scriptures that were revealed before the Quran that were God's revealed scripture. And to name the three prominent ones would include the Torah of Moses, of Musa, and the Psalms of David, of Dawood, and the Gospel of Jesus, the Injil of Isa, peace be on all the prophets. And of course there are many other books and scriptures that were revealed which perhaps we are not aware of. The Arabic would classify the recipients of these books as the people of the book, the Ahlul Kitab. So we have all these different classifications of non-Muslims from a Muslim point of view. And I'm sure that would probably be the case, certainly from other faith perspectives. Indeed, from the Christian perspective, I would have thought that non-Christians would perhaps be classified as infidels. And this is why when you look at Orientalist material, we find that infidel is used for non-Muslim. And perhaps being a translation of kafir on the part of Orientalists. As we've reflected on the contributions made by Muslims to Britain, academic and otherwise, so the question is, what positive benefits can today's Muslims bring to Britain? I think if we practice our faith sincerely and honestly, there's a lot that we can bring to society in terms of honesty, of kindness, of modesty, of being true to your faith and practicing your faith and not allowing it to be diluted because of public pressure, for example, that God's law comes before all other law. That God's law cannot be changed to suit us, but we have to change in order to be able to fulfill God's law. Some of these things are missing from British society today, and it saddens me very much, and I have expressed this to my friends amongst the Christian clergy and in other faiths, that I don't see why you have to give in to pressure from the public for whatsoever reason there might be, and you want to bring a change in your religious laws. These are sacred laws. If you believe in your religion that these are sacred laws laid down by God, then how can you change them because there's pressure being put on you? And I was amazed to find myself participating in an interview on the World Service, BBC World Service, where one of the bishops in Britain had suggested that Christian worship, which traditionally takes place on Sundays, should no longer take place on Sundays because people don't turn up. And they should look for an alternative time or day or something. And I was surprised to find myself talking over the phone line in the interview, defending the Christian position to say, why should you stop worshiping on a Sunday just because people don't come? You can't make religion suit humankind. The test is the human being should be able to live their life according to the teachings of the faith, the teachings of the religion. And I could easily have said, if I wanted to say, well, I don't believe in Christianity, so if you do away with worship on a Sunday, fine, good, do it. But the thing is, we live in a society where religion really is becoming unfashionable. It's not the thing to do, for example. And if we as religious people fail to support one another as people of faith, as people of religion, then our position becomes weaker. I think what we need to do now is to support and get behind, rally behind one another and support each other in the practice of our religion. And we've seen examples of that. We saw with the issue of the headscarf, scores, perhaps hundreds, if not thousands of non-Muslims, Christian, Jews, Hindu, Sikh, Buddhist, whoever they might be, or even people of no faith, felt that this was a religious right, a human right, that was being taken away, and people should be allowed to wear the headscarf if they wanted to. And I think Muslims need to reciprocate that. We cannot just expect others to support us when we are in need of support. I think if others need our support, then we should be there to support their cause. If faith communities become strong in this country, I think we as Muslims will also benefit from that position, that we will be in a society where faith has a place. Unlike, I think, France, which is going down a very slippery slope, where faith really hasn't got much space, at least in politics. They've totally separated the state from religion since the Civil War some a century and a half ago. This is a very interesting question, this one, and I've been told that these two are perhaps similar, that whether Islam is at a threat from the West, from the US, the UK, and indeed other Western countries. Very interesting question. Perhaps Muslims in Muslim lands ought to stand up and start screaming and shouting, say, you are a threat to us. I think Islam and Muslims are not at a threat from people living in the Western Hemisphere. It's the governments that can be pinpointed. There have been times, for example, if we look back at the tragedy in the Balkans, we find that it was the US and perhaps it was Western governments that, albeit very late and belatedly, nevertheless took the steps to make sure that the genocide of Muslims and others came to an end, and the oppressors were taken to task and were removed out of the equation. So it's not always the case where Muslim lands can be threatened or have been threatened by so-called Western powers. I think it's a changing situation. Today's friend could be your enemy tomorrow in terms of governments. We can see how, when it was useful for the West, Saddam was their buddy. And when it no longer served their goals, he became a baddie, and you get rid of him. So it's a changing situation. Politics, unfortunately, I think because it is empty of a faith dimension, it becomes selfish, it becomes brutal. I think faith is very, very important, an integral part of politics, which is why as Muslims we do not differentiate between politics and Islam or between politics and faith. For us, Islam is a complete way of life, and politics falls within that bracket of life. It's inbuilt, it's an integral part of the faith. But that's an interesting question, and I think I'm going to explore this a little further. This other one, it talks about how things are going in Britain and America and others, and it says it's only a matter of time before we get kicked out of this country. I think we need to be realistic. Of course, we can't be complacent. We can't sit back and say, well, everything is rosy in this country and everything is fine, which is why I feel it's so important for us as Muslims, and also for my other non-Muslim friends from a different religion, that we engage in British life, in mainstream situations. Whatever is happening in this country, we have a stake in it. We have to claim a stake in it. And I think we have to engage, like you all are. You're engaging at a very high level in an educational establishment. Once you have your degrees, God willing, you'll be able to access the employment market. You'll be able to be in positions where you can contribute positively to the betterment of society and of humankind. Some of you might go into politics. And that has certainly been my message to young Muslim men, women, that we definitely need to engage in mainstream politics. We cannot isolate ourselves. If we want to bring a change which will serve us better in this country, then we cannot lock ourselves away in some corner. We have to venture out and get in there and try and bring about a change in there. And just this reminds me of this kicked out bit. If the chair will allow me something that I have shared with other young students in other parts of the country. With regard to the negative portrayal of Islam, when it is alleged that Islam was spread by force and people were forced to convert to Islam and so on and so forth, I want to tie this in with the earlier question, what British Muslims can do in Britain. In the depth of my heart, I would sincerely want all British people, not just British people, I would want every human being in the world to follow the way of life of Islam. I'd be lying to you if I said otherwise. And I think if somebody strongly believes that their religion is the best for humankind, then they will feel the same. They will want everybody to be like them or to follow a religion like theirs. That's human nature, that if you believe in something to be the best, you want it for everybody. Again, it's all part of the process of demonization of Muslims and of Islam. And I can give you a very simple example of Spain, Muslim Spain. We heard earlier on when the Spanish Armada threatened Britain, how the British approached the Muslims for help and so on and so forth. Of course, there was a time when Muslims ruled Spain for centuries. The simple question here is, if Islam was truly spread by force and people were forced to become Muslims, then all of Spain would certainly have been Muslim. Either those who rejected would have been killed or would have been expelled and sent away somewhere on ships to faraway lands. And I say this, and I say it with a heavy heart, with deep sadness, that the Muslims understood the teachings of the Quran, that you cannot force Islam on anyone and you cannot give guidance to anyone to Islam. It is God who chooses who he wants to guide to Islam. That we left sufficient non-Muslims in Spain, enough of them that they were able to kick us out. And this is, I think, something that we must talk about. Look at India, for example. The recent tragedies in Gujarat. The innocent lives that were lost on all sides. Muslims ruled India for centuries. And if it was all about forced conversion, I'm not denying that there were incidents, isolated incidents. That is something perhaps very difficult to avoid. But there is no sort of active policy that you have to force people to become Muslim. And despite the centuries of rule in India, India still remains a majority Hindu country where the Muslims are a minority. If it was a case of imposing one's faith on others, I think all those centuries of rule would have enabled Muslims to convert the Hindus and the other religious communities in India to become Muslim. But this was something that that triggered off from that word kicked out of this country. We hear many times politicians, many times people in the media, and members of the public coming onto the radio or other media agencies saying that if you don't like our way of life, go back home. Or maybe I could go back to Malawi because that's where I came from. But most of you were born in this country and this is your home. So if you want to go back home, you just go back to Britain. You're already in Britain. So where do you go? Either they ship you off to Mars or something. I understand they found some evidence that there might be some H2O lying down somewhere. But the point is that we are now part and parcel of Britain. As Muslims and members of other religions, we form British society and we have a stake in it. And if each one of us has the desire to contribute to nation building, to the betterment of British society, I think people will appreciate us. It is when we fail to do that, that the indigenous, especially the indigenous population, begin to dislike us or some of us. So that is a crucial point. The whole table is full of questions. I don't know if you want me to go on with this. You mentioned tolerance a few times. You think Muslims have a lot to learn about that. That is the tolerance of our own different Muslim traditions. Absolutely. Absolutely. This is key to Muslim unity in this country. When you live in a non-Muslim country, it is absolutely important that Muslims are united. And I'll tell you some a very interesting experience that I have had personally. For many years I've engaged with non-Muslims, that is Christians, Jews, Hindus and other religious people. With some of them at a very intimate level of engagement, of dialogue, certainly with Christians. And it was during this encounter where I realized that I was making such a great effort in trying to build bridges with Christians, in trying to understand Christianity, in trying to dispel the misconceptions that they have about Islam and Muslims. And one day I sat back and I asked myself, why is it that I'm not utilizing the same kind of energy and devoting the same amount of time to building bridges with fellow Muslims who are different to my tradition? And that was my wake-up call. I woke up suddenly and I realized that why do I have no motivation to reach out and get to know a Shia? Because I'm a Sunni, I don't want to know a Shia. Why don't I reach out to a Muslim who believes differently from my Sunni tradition? They have a different Sunni tradition. And why do I always put them down or talk them down and things like that? And I thank God that once that dawned on me, I really now have no time for sectarian dialogue or discussions. If a Muslim wants to grow a beard, grow it. If you don't want to grow it, don't grow it. God up there is going to deal with us. If you want to wear a hat when you pray, wear it. You don't want to wear it, don't wear it. I honestly don't have time to go into those little things. There are more serious issues that we face as Muslims in this country and globally. We need to unite ourselves. We need to give room to others. And sometimes I sit back and wonder, why did we end up with four? Many of us follow the four schools of law in Islam. How come we ended up with four? Because there is room for diversity. Because there was room for the second and the third and the fourth school of thought. And there is room for those who don't want to follow these schools of thought. So we really need to grow up. Forgive me for using that word, but we need to grow up and move away from those sectarian issues. These are fiqh issues. And if you look at the Muslim tradition, this is supposed to be a kind of blessing. The diversity within the practice of Islam is supposed to be a blessing. What we refer to as ikhtilaful ummah rahmah, that the diversity between the Muslims is supposed to be a source of blessing, because each one is practicing Islam in the way that they have learned, reflecting back on the Messenger Muhammad's practice. If we're all the same, doing everything similarly, I think I would have found things to be rather boring, not challenging. So I hope that we can move on to uniting ourselves and then also be able to unite with the wider community. Myself being a non-Muslim, I believe each and every person to be a brother or a sister. As a Muslim, do you see everyone as brothers or sisters? Are we not all equal? Are we all not family? Absolutely. I see every human being as a brother and a sister. and I can't see them as anything less. If they choose not to practice Islam, that is their choice. I'm not God, I don't want to judge that person. If I start doing that, God will be unemployed. So that is not for me to do. My duty as a Muslim is to treat every human being with kindness, with respect. I give respect, I get respect. And the Messenger of God, Muhammad, peace be on him, in many of his teachings, has emphasized the caring of fellow human beings, of neighbors, of mankind in general, and of all creation, whether they're animals or plants. And many times we talk of jihad and war and so on and so forth. Let me tell you that that has a place in Islam, but Muslim soldiers who were sent out to fight oppression were actually commanded to respect religious places, places of worship, not to go inside and capture or kill enemies who sought refuge in those places of worship. They were instructed not to burn vegetation, crops and plantations, or cut down trees. They were instructed not to mutilate dead bodies of enemies. And I reflect back and think about it. But this is war. Everything should, you know, should be okay. It's like what the civilized Western powers are doing today with their gadgety warplanes and all that. And you just drop the cluster bombs, you just drop the daisy cutters and all that, and you kill thousands of innocent people alongside that. Reflect back on the teaching of Islam, that even your dead enemy, the body should not be mutilated. And that should teach us Muslims that even in the situation of war, of battle, we are to give respect. So think about it. What about when we're at